We're here talking to Major General Fitz. This is Side B, and we're just talking about mortar fire.
Yes, the mortar fire controller, it was quite obvious that we had a short. And when I went out, I found out that, in fact, a crew had placed on the side of the sandbags around the trench the charges they'd taken off, and they took one too many off that particular round. That happens. It's fairly easy to get confused. This was not our normal weapon. It perhaps teaches a lesson that you may think you're getting a break when you borrow weapons, or you secure weapons from another source, or you secure vehicles, but when it comes to spare parts and familiarity, you're trusting people to become proficient without sort of training background that you would normally get on your own, or without supply background you would normally have on your own. That was a friendly fire incident that I don't talk too much about. There was another one that I do mention on frequent occasions, and of course it's somebody else's problem. The guns were called in support of us one evening when we were on this hook position, on the hook position, and we called for fire support or a target to be fired. And got the target approved, and a troop was assigned, fired its four ranging rounds, I guess, or whatever it's called in artillery parlance, and three went over the crest and one didn't. And crest clearance was a problem there, but however, our gunner officer thought that perhaps we didn't recognize it properly, and he called for a repeat of the target. I called out to the platoon and said, everybody get down and stay down. We're repeating that target. They fired again, and sure enough, one of the rounds was short. This time he did take our word for it, and I guess they went off and recalibrated their guns at the gun line or whatever you do to correct that issue. So friendly fire incidents do occur. They are not something that you can be terribly proud of. But thankful that you, I guess, avoided being casualties in the times that those things occur. After the events at on the mortar base plate, we moved over behind 355, which is almost the identical spot I had started from a year earlier. And my last few months, a few weeks in Korea, from roughly mid-May to early July, just before the armistice, were spent in a position, mortar position, behind 355. That concluded a year of deployments, and we caught a number of different significant events. When I look back, most of the large attacks that were involved during that period, we were somehow affected by and participated in, not necessarily the initial assaults, but the events which unfolded gathered up me in various different roles, and it gave me a perspective on that war, which is one of, when I look back, one of admiration for the people who served there. Often the experience is credited with being carried out by Canadian soldiers who joined the Special Force. In fact, the Special Force time in Korea was relatively short. Some of it was spent preparing to go there. Most of the last two rotations that took place before the ceasefire were taken by units of the regular army. And it's the first time that regular army troops had been deployed in that particular, in numbers like that, before the NATO deployment started to pick up steam later on. But the casualties which were caused there were caused by a number of different factors. A lot of them were enemy action, a lot of them were accidents, a lot of them were disease, even some friendly fires. Casualties. I have visited Korea a number of times and have had sensitivity built, I guess, through involvement since that period with the Korea Veterans Association and some of the projects that they have been dealing with, notably the Wall of Remembrance in Brampton, and the latterly a not such a deep involvement, but a sort of a public involvement with Monument to the Fallen in Ottawa. My whole experience, I guess, leads me to be particularly interested in perpetuating the memory of the people who fought and particularly died there, but also those who served there. I looked at a history not very long ago of that period, written by Canadian historians, and the things that stand out in their minds are things other than the Korean War. It has been referred to frequently as the Forgotten War, and it's not difficult to see why. Because of its close proximity to the end of the Second World War, which is a monumental Canadian national effort, this one took place in a part of the world in which we were not terribly conscious of, nor I don't think was sort of politically an area we wanted to get involved in, particularly after the debacle at Hong Kong. It is an event which took place very soon after the end of a war in which our politicians, I think, felt we did not really want to repeat that close because of war weariness on their part, and they perceived the Canadian public's part. On the other hand, the Canadian public, recognizing the kind of aggression which had taken place that caused the outbreak of the Korean War, seemed to lead the politicians, once again, in responding to what they thought was a worthwhile international commitment to prevent unwarranted aggression or unprovoked aggression on the part of people who were determined to change the political and social order in various parts of the world. We were just coming through the Russian expansionism in Europe. Very conscious of what communism was or could be in the minds of ourselves, and I guess Korea was the area in which a line was going to be drawn and which communism was going to be faced down. It was done relatively successfully, and certainly it gave me as a soldier an insight into combat that I would not have gotten any other way. It probably was also pivotal in my decision to remain in the Army and make a career out of professional soldiering from that point on. I joined, if you will, as a cadet in 1948 and retired as a major general in 1978. 30 years of my life was devoted to that particular profession. One in which I was very proud. Not only was the Korean War a significant event in my life, but it set up for me, I guess, involvement in a number of other ways. I was the adjutant of a unit which was tasked as the first unit to go into the United Nations Emergency Force at the Suez in 1956. Many of us were Korean veterans at that time, and putting together that operation turned out to be an exhausting but very interesting event, and we were calling on experience which we had gained over a period of time in preparing units to do that.
So let's just go all the way back to your early days. Why, or let's talk about your family first. What was the makeup of your family?
I was in what would be considered, I guess, a sort of model family in terms of its structure. I had a father and a mother and a younger brother, by 2 years younger than me, and a younger sister, 8 years younger than me. So there was a family of five. And all of us lived in Nelson until the time that my father left to go to World War II. He left in very early 1940. I had turned 10 at the outbreak of that war. And he was gone until I was 16 plus. So I was very much impacted by the Second War. I was old enough to understand what was going on, old enough to read newspaper articles, periodicals, watch newsreels, and relate to it fairly personally because of my own father's involvement in the war. He went overseas in 1940 and didn't come back home until 1945. I also went through the junior high and high school period in that time, knowing people in the neighborhood whose family was affected by war and by the casualties caused by war. In the early days, it was principally aircrew that were involved. My high school, the one that I went to, was a relatively small high school. I don't think the student population was more than about 200 in Nelson High School. And the honor roll in that school is 27 of young people who were school graduates, graduates meaning people of the upper grades in that high school, who died during the war. One of the most notable was our next door neighbor. I lived with my grandmother for a short time after my father came back from the war and set up a pharmacy business in Castle Gar, which is not far from Nelson. And I lived with my grandmother, who lived next door to a family called Gray. During the early part of the war, like 1943-44, I can recall visiting my grandmother and seeing some distraught look on her face, and she had said that she'd just talked to Mrs. Gray next door and they had lost their son Jack in a bombing raid, and it was assumed that he was killed. That same family, right at the end of the war, lost Hampton Gray, who was the Victoria Cross winner, in an attack on a Japanese ship in a Japanese harbor. He was subsequently awarded the Victoria Cross. But there are next door neighbors who lost their only two sons. There was a daughter, but their two sons were killed during the war. And that left, I guess, an indelible memory on my part, but also I know of other families in that small community, and sang in choirs with some of the young men, participated in scouts with some of the young men, participated in cadets with some of the young men, all of whom were a few years older than I was, who eventually were killed in the war or seriously wounded. So that in a small community where people know each other, Nelson being one of them, because the population was only about 5,500, I think, at that time, word got around as to who was suffering, who was hurt, who had had a loss. And most of us were very cognizant through rationing, through newspaper announcements, through death announcements, that this was a costly endeavor that we were in. And I don't know, it probably set me up to be very appreciative of the service that the Army was, the forces, was giving to the country, particularly when near the end of the war, the Army was involved to a large degree, and a large number of the casualties were coming in from Army sources. But it's a small town approach, I guess, to living. We knew each other, we worked with each other, we played with each other, we sang with each other, and in the end we suffered with each other and appreciated each other's efforts. So my upbringing, as I say, was probably quite normal for kids at that time of the year. I had to earn my spending money by a number of different means. My father, when he joined up as a private soldier, and he was a pharmacist by trade and went to the medical corps, which is a logical place for a pharmacist to ply his trade. But he had some peculiar elements in his background, or particular elements, let's put it that way, in his background, which made him give his service in a different way. Because of the Depression that was just ending, he in fact had lost his partnership in a drugstore in Nelson, because there wasn't enough money coming in to support two families. So he, being the junior partner, lost that element of support. He then went to work for the fire department as a fireman. And that was the steady job in the Depression, which kept us fed and clothed pretty well. And when he joined the Army, the general hospital that he was assigned to found out he'd been a fireman, and they needed a fire picket commander or a fire marshal of their own to check out fire precautions and make sure they were followed. in the unit. So he ended up starting out as, ended up starting out, he started out as a, as the fireman or the fire marshal of 16th General Hospital. And then they found out that he had had some bugle band experience. He played a drum in a band, the Legion Bugle Band in Nelson between the wars. And although he wasn't a veteran of the First World War, he was in the Legion Bugle Band. And so he was then put to work as, to form a small bugle band. All of these things combined to make him the provost sergeant of the unit. So he ended up with a kind of a three-hat job, retired as a lance sergeant at the end of the war. And I was very cognizant of the fact of what he was doing and who he was. And he eventually came back after the war, started a drugstore in Castlegar on borrowed money. Ran the drugstore for a number of years, and then decided when he got an offer he couldn't refuse to sell the store, and became a magistrate in the area and did that job until he died rather prematurely at the age of 66 in 1970. By that time, I had been in the Army a considerable period of time and was a student at the, or a course member at the National Defense College in Kingston when he passed away. But he had tracked my career and the career of my brother and my sister. My brother is a geologist, was working for a number of the larger oil companies for years. My sister is a nurse and was a practicing nurse in Vancouver and in Castlegar after qualifying as a registered nurse. So the family was, if you will, sort of professionally oriented, and all of us have survived the war. But the one person that I've really got to give credit to in all of this is my mother. She brought three kids through about 5.5 years of war on a pittance, earning in a way. And I think her pay that she got from the government, not her pay, but my father's pay, who was channeled to her, was $90 a month. And she brought the three of us through our teenage years and paid the mortgage on the house out of that money. And as I say, I had to earn my own spending money, which was, from everybody's point of view, what I should be doing. And from my own point of view, I guess made me less accountable for how I spent it. So I spent it, I guess I started off as a newspaper carrier. I then ended up as a newspaper carrier and a grocery delivery boy during the time that goods were rationed. So the grocery store owner that I worked for always made sure that we got our rationed quota without question. He would always put something away from my mother, because he was involved in the First World War as a soldier, and he knew, I guess, what she was going through. In any event, we never really suffered for want of anything, mainly through her efforts. And I then went worked in the CPR as a bridge and building crew member, painting the bridges on the Kettle Valley Railway in the summer times for 3 years. Worked in a sawmill at night 1 year. Worked in a machine shop at night for 1 year, because all these things, the nighttime employments for me, freed me to play baseball in the daylight hours. We didn't have floodlights in our ballparks at that time. But working as a machinist, I could pick my own hours, and I sharpened mining drill bits for an uncle who ran a machine shop, and I could do as many as I wanted on one night, or as few as I wanted, as long as he could meet his delivery dates. So I operated on that basis, and it really freed me up to play baseball and a few other things that I really wanted to do. And it was good quality ball in those days. Lots of hockey, lots of basketball, lots of curling, lots of soccer. We had a sports program in a small place like that that was second to none. There was no sports that we didn't play, and most of them we played reasonably well. I got an offer the year I was coming down to Royal Roads. I got an offer that summer to go to a tryout for the St. Louis Browns, which were one of the baseball teams at that time. Well, I didn't take it up because I had already committed to come to Royal Roads and I was anxious to get started in that. But the caliber of ball we played was pretty good, and I was picked up by a scout in the northern part of Washington where we used to go and play in either Idaho or Washington, some of the teams there. And during the war, that was one of the major entertainments was sports, and baseball in the summer in particular.
So what made you join the military? Was it your father?
Or? No. I think it was the a number of different requirements, and one of them may not be very obvious. Obviously, I was interested in the military, I think, because of the age I was during the war. I also knew a lot of young people who had served in the military and who had returned to Nelson after the war. Some didn't come back, as we've discussed. If I had to say why, I guess it was a fascination with things military, not anything in particular, just a general fascination, and I didn't really know very much about the college system. And my father was struggling to get established in a new drug business. That was taking all the resources that he had. I wanted to get a college education, and going to university seemed to be a little out of the question for somebody from the interior of BC coming down to UBC, which was probably the only college I really could recognize, or university I could recognize at that point. It seemed to be an expensive proposition, and then I read an advertisement pushed at me by one of my teachers that said you can get a university type education by applying for the Canadian Services Colleges. So I wrote the entrance exam and was accepted. I went to the interviews in Vancouver and passed them, I guess, and found out that I was on my way to a military college, having passed the assessments and had the required grades in my senior matric exams in BC, which was great. I combined sort of a fascination, I guess, for the military, but my real aim was to get a degree, a bachelor's degree, because in my own mind, I was setting up a drop-back position. Teaching always interested me, and so did medicine, so that the military thing didn't work out, at least I had a step towards getting into teaching or medicine if I wanted to pursue that. So I guess if the truth were known, my father couldn't really afford to help me very much getting into university. I had given up a lot of free time to him to get him established in his drug business, because I had done a lot of painting and shelving and stocking and things for him too, off and on during that last 2-year period I was at home. So things worked out that I went to Royal Roads, and from then on, I guess I got hooked. I trained as an Armored Corps cadet because that's what I wanted to do. There were scenes in my mind, I guess, of what soldiering was like, and tanks were one of the things that kind of interested me. I applied for and was accepted in a Western Armored Regiment, very happy to be assigned there. Your choice of regiment to some degree was based on your standing in your class academically and in a leadership sense. So I got what I wanted, and it wasn't until I got to Korea where that suddenly was changed for me. And I guess what I didn't say in the previous interview in Korea was that after about 8 months being an infantry platoon commander, I began to get very close to these people. And I thought, geez, you know, I haven't had a chance to serve in the Strathconas, and I may not even get a chance, although I was supposed to be sent there for a 3-month tour out of that 12-month period in Korea. Each of us were to go in rotation, and mine was the last name in a rotation of 5 people because I was last in alphabetical order. And when you're competing with Bells and Bulls and Blacks, and the other guy is a P, all right, but he's a Patterson, not a Pitts. I was the last one to be asked to go. And when they asked for me, the Patricias had me and Wee John Boo as their instructor, and they were unhappy about replacing me. And about that time is when I decided I would apply for a Corps transfer. So that's how I ended up being an infantryman.
So your training at Royal Roads, what the basic training consist of at the university?
Well, that was, I guess, from an outsider's point of view, one could say that it looks like military colleges probably do a lot of military training. In fact, what is structured in your daily routine makes allowances for a bit of military studies in terms of drill and organization. You don't get into tactics. You don't get into specific items around equipment or anything. That's all done in a summer period. Actually, the structure is done in a military way. The organization of the college is done in a military way. But the studies are practically all either arts or engineering. They are history, English, languages, chemistry, mechanical drawing, math, those things. In fact, in the early days when we went in, we had a combined arts and engineering course each of the first 2 years. It wasn't until we got to the third year that we were allowed to specialize in any way. My choice took me off into arts, history, geography, language, social studies, and that sort of thing. But I couldn't get away from the engineering side of it, the maths and physics, fast enough, quite frankly. So I was very glad to have survived the first 2 years, which was this common arts engineering curriculum, to get into what was more of an arts program the last 2 years. All of the military training, if it's military training in the sense of real hands-on environmental stuff like land, sea, and air, is done in the summertime. And we spent 3 summers in Corps, as we called it, Corps training in the Army, in which I spent 2 in Camp Borden, and the subjects we got involved in were tank gunnery, tank maintenance, tank signals, general military training, which was basically infantry training, but driver maintenance and tank gunnery were specific to those, and those were all covered in the first 2 years. The third year, you were supposed to go and practice some of this stuff in an armored regiment. I never did that. Maybe this is where my separation from my chosen corps took place, in that I was hived off to an infantry training camp in Aldershot, Nova Scotia, after requesting to go to Calgary, Alberta. So there's what happens in the Army if you make a specific quest for a specific location. You probably won't get it. But in fact, it turned out to be, for me, a godsend, because I got my feet really dirty on the infantry side in that third practical phase by accident. And I got into the hands of some Second World War veterans, some very dedicated young professional NCOs and sergeants, who were the supervising staff for this pilot course that I was one of the platoon commanders on. So I was well supported by some knowledgeable and experienced people, and I learned a lot during that summer, which in hindsight set me up pretty well.
So how old were you when you graduated and were commissioned?
I went in at 19 and out at 22.
Okay.
23, pardon me, 23. Yeah, in at 19, out at 23.
And you said it was an option to be commissioned into a regiment. Why did you choose?
Mainly because of the fascination with the tank and the stories about that sort of involvement and those sorts of operations during the Second War when I was doing the reading. And also, I tended to try and shy away from the infantry stuff. That seemed to be a little bit plain from my point of view. I've never regretted being shoved that way, but in the initial instance, a little more romantic to be on the cavalry side of things, I guess. And I made a choice at a fairly young stage in my life without much experience, and I would, if circumstances hadn't worked out the way it did for me, about somebody making a choice for me, I'd have been happily soldiering on as a Strathcona, I'm sure, all these years, as opposed to an infantryman. But my infantry experience has turned out to be a member of 2 very fine regiments, the Princess Patricia's and the Queen's Own Rifles of Canada, as well as a commander of the Canadian Airborne Regiment when it was at its zenith out here in the West.
When did you find out you were going to be sent to Korea?
As I mentioned earlier in that tape, we didn't know we were actually going to go to Korea until about March of 1952. There was rumors then circulating that if we were successful in our examination and if we accepted a regular commission, we would go to Korea on graduation. March, April, May, June. We graduated in the first week in June, and we were in Korea, some of us, in the middle of July.
So in between the time, you said you had some leave?
30 days. 30 days in travel time.
Did you have any practical training in between graduation and going to Korea?
No. It was what you had collected over the previous 4 years.
So did you feel you were on your way to Korea? This time you were still with the Strathcona horse?
I was wearing Strathcona kit, caboodle, and I arrived at the Patricia's wearing Strathcona kit and was told politely, go away and look like a Patricia, come back and I'll tell you which company you're going to.
Did you feel that your training would be enough when you're sent to Korea?
Yes. I felt it was enough, and I was prepared to exercise it with what I knew. But I don't think I really realized that I didn't know all that much. I was facing an adventure which was fascinating. It was going to be challenging. Certainly when I left this side of the ocean, I was going into something that I never did get into. I never did go to the tanks except to visit when they were in our position beside us. And my friends were there, the people I'd trained with. But I guess I began to realize that maybe I should know a little bit more or have a little more experience before taking command. When I went to the British and spent some time there early in my time in Korea, without the onus of leadership or responsibility, I was an observer. And then I got a break when I went to the NCO school. I was sort of forced into a more structured approach to junior tactics, low-level tactics, let's put it that way, platoon and section tactics. The rest of it was what you picked up by inference and by association. Patrol tactics, we went out and exercised. We were on numerous patrols as young people, and they ranged from fire bases or fighting patrols to ambushes to standing patrols, observing patrols, escort patrols, taking people of other corps out like engineers to gap or to repair minefields. There was lots of activity, and as I was saying during the early part of the original recording, we spent a lot of time in the valley. In the valley meant really out on patrols of various descriptions, and it depended a large degree on how many officers you had to do this, and companies normally got tasked by rotation. And you may recall that in my earlier stage, when I first went to that company, there were three platoon commanders. When I left the company or went with the company out of the line, there was only one. So it was getting to be a fairly frequent occurrence to be tasked to do work in the valley of various descriptions, and it began to be a little bit stressful. There's no doubt about that. But then there are periods of excitement which seem to erase the stress of sort of the routine things when you're out in the valley. There are things like the attack on 355, which opens up a whole new spectrum of things for you, a whole new involvement. Then the hook thing and the rewiring and the time in the mortar line. I felt I had a very balanced career by the time I came out of there. Was regarded by the CO as one of his, quote, veteran platoon commanders, although I'd only been commissioned probably about 8 or 10 months by that time. But it's, you pick up experience very quickly, and you've got to learn quickly, and you listen to people, you assess what they say, you take into account what orders are given to you, because presumably they're based upon somebody's knowledge of how to do things. Otherwise, they wouldn't ask you to do it that way. and you've got to fit in the flesh around the bones that you're given, or the outline you're given of operations. So I felt maybe I could have had more knowledge when I went in, but I had a lot of spirit, a lot of energy, a lot of enthusiasm. I was ready to tackle anything. I was just hoping people were prepared to go with me, and as it turned out, they were.
Do you think being an armor officer and then taking over an infantry platoon, did the soldiers in your platoon know that?
Not really.
No?
No. Some may have, but I doubt it. As far as they were concerned, I was a Patricia officer, and I think in hindsight, that's what Colonel Cameron, the CO, meant when he said, go get dressed as a Patricia officer and I'll tell you where you're going. I never highlighted the fact that I was a Strathcona while I was there. I similarly would never have hit it if in fact the subject had arisen. The people who knew were some other officers in the battalion, and certainly my four brother Strathconas or Army Corps officers I went over with, but not a lot of other people knew that. I never dwelt on it, and it so happened that the experiences I gained were came pretty fast and furious and fairly early in my time there, so I felt very competent.
So Hill 355, you were describing the battle before, and you were on a position looking towards the hill?
We were in a position overlooked. Yeah, right.
Apologies.
It was a very high dominating feature, and we were snuggled up against the right or the eastern side of it. And you could look from 355 down into our position. Similarly, you could look from 355 across into the Chinese areas, which at that point were about a mile apart. There was a bend in the line which left a lot of low ground in that area. Nobody wanted to occupy it. And that's where this valley turmoil took place,
right,
because there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and changing of paths and mining and tripwires and that sort of thing in order to catch people on the other side by surprise. So there was the feature was so important that it had to be protected. And practically all of the battalions, whether they were British, Australian, or ourselves, got whacked there. I don't mean that every battalion, but I think every nationality, that is British, Australian, and Canadian forces who were on that feature got hit at some point. I don't know whether there was really an honest attempt by the Chinese to attack and hold it and keep it. There were certainly some tries which would indicate that. I haven't read anything in material on their side which would have led me to believe that there was an intense desire or an intention to take it. I feel it's still a justification, and I think if the feature had ever fallen, it would have been quickly occupied by the other side. The intention was that it would not, as far as we were concerned. And the same with the Hook. It was a position, but much closer in proximity to enemy sides on the other side of the Commonwealth line. Those two positions were critical and had to be held.
You said before that before the attack on 355, you were shelled with artillery fire?
We received a lot of artillery fire, and some of it, I think, was to disguise the area of the eventual attack on 355. The position on that feature that was going to be attacked, we were on the front, right up against it, so it's conceivable that they may have tried to come in that way, although that's not like the Chinese. They would normally have gone for the top of the hill, which is what they did. But the registration of targets is such that they can suppress supporting fire that they expect to be delivered along the base of 355, which we could have provided some. We could fire across the base of that hill. If ever the company there was in a position to have the area lit or fire on fixed and predetermined lines, they could have caused a lot of difficulties for the Chinese. So part of it was registration for suppression. The other, I think, was harassing fire to disguise just what their intentions were.
And you also said at one point you were on the line with your platoon for a number of months.
Yeah. I was a platoon commander from from the end of July, but in fact I went into the line about the second week in August and came out of the line in the period between Christmas and New Year's, which makes it really all of August, September, October, November, December. There was about five straight months there without a break. Now, the break that some people got was denied to my company because we went up to become Peter Company of 1RCR. And that was what sort of took a period of a week away from the line for us. When I came out with my platoon in the period between December and January, the battalion and the brigade never went back into the line. They were withdrawn for refitting. The Commonwealth Division went into Corps Reserve, or whatever the expression was, which meant they were all out of the line for rest, rehabilitation, reinforcement, refitting. And that's the period I spent at the NCO school with my nose in the books, which was fine.
Being on the line for 5 months straight as a platoon commander, how was morale and how was the situation controlling morale of your troops?
Well, from my point of view, it wasn't that difficult because I was dealing with two different groups in the main. One was from 1st Battalion from August, September, and October, 3 months. The second was the new battalion coming in. Now, there were some holdovers in individuals, but the new battalion was coming in November and December when I was in the line. So I had 2 months with a platoon from a new battalion and 3 months with the old battalion. The old battalion was more of a challenge because rotation was coming up. The new battalion was full of enthusiasm and vigor and wanting to get into the job. They were a very enthusiastic group, and that was the group that I was with in the minefield and wiring situation. They were very easy to, easy to command. They were easy to lead. They would follow, and they would make no bones about it. They would show me the way at times, too. I was kind of a shared leadership guy, I guess, to some degree, in that I tried to allow people below me some initiative and leadership. I was not the dictatorial boss. I was a team leader, and that worked quite well from my point of view. So with the 1st Battalion group in the early stages, I was relying on some of their experiences. But I found the closer we got to rotation, the more hesitant people became about volunteering, about wanting to do things. And the only real discipline problem I had was up on top of 355 when we were days away from rotation. And a Lance Corporal whose turn it was to go and take an OP out near the junction point of the Patricias and the RCR refused to go. And I said, look, I'll give you one more chance. I said, if you don't go, you expect one of these other fellows who's rotating to take your job? He said, I can't do it. And I said, okay, if that's your last word and you can't do it and you won't do it, you're going to the company. I can't do it. So he went to the company commander and was sent under the direction of the company sergeant major with a couple of people off to the battalion RP section. I probably came and picked him up, regimental police section. And I don't know what happened to him. I was never called upon to make out a charge sheet, never called upon to swear a charge. The company commander called me and said on the phone, heard what happened, and I said, I gave him two chances to go. It was his turn, and terms have been shared here regardless of personal wants or dislikes. We tried to do it dispassionately, objectively, so everyone felt that they were doing their turn, and I wasn't asking anybody to step in and take an extra turn. Nor would I in this case. So I said, sir, he refused to go after one warning, and I said, I'll give you one more chance, and I'm going to send him up to you. I sent him up to him, to the captain, and He was gone with the car sergeant major's hand around his neck, is what I heard, and down, I guess, to meet the RPs who were going to pick him up somewhere and take him back to the battalion. What happened to him, I really don't know, because that's when the change of the battalions took place, and I really don't know what happened. I suspect that he was sentenced to some time in the field detention barracks for refusing an order. That's the only one that occurred to me.
So then that morale was good?
Yeah, I thought so. Considering the kind of circumstances, I would much rather have gone with a unit into the theater to start with than be a reinforcement coming in at a reinforcement officer coming in with only 2 or 3 months to go and strength being depleted towards the rotation period. Things went very well from my point of view, and I had no real problems except that one, and it stuck in my mind. I know the name, but I'm not prepared to mention it at this point. It's immaterial.
How did you find your equipment? Were you well equipped?
Yeah, I thought we were. People have said we should have had a lot more rapid firing weapons. Perhaps we should have, but I found that we were fairly well stocked. We used to have 2 Bren guns per section, which was 2 automatic firing weapons, light machine guns, and they were great. We had a 30 caliber per platoon that we had, so we had lots of firepower in static positions. The real problem was when we went out on patrol and you'd like to lug some of this stuff along. Lugging a 30 caliber was not going to be very, very proficient. Lugging the light machine guns were, the Brens were taken frequently. What we didn't have was any rapid firing rifles, and that was the normal equipment for an infantryman. The section commanders had Stens, and I as a platoon commander.